On Wednesday, May 1st, Humabon requested that the Armada's leaders attend a feast. The invitation promised a lavish meal, accompanied by gifts of jewels and other presents. In all, about 37 men, most of them officers, decided to accept. This was a large contingent, approximately a quarter of the entire crew. Their number included Barbosa and Serrano, the new co-commanders, as well as their astrologer and astronomer, Andres de San Martin. Pigafetta was also invited to the feast, but, as he later explained, I could not go because I was all swollen from the wound of a poison arrow that I had received in the forehead. He had sustained his injury at Magellan's side during the Battle of Mactan. Shortly after the officers went ashore, Pigafetta, recovering on board Trinidad, was startled to hear Carvalho, the Portuguese pilot, and the master-at-arms, Espinosa, returning unexpectedly. Pigafetta listened apprehensively as, in Pigafetta's words, they told us that they had seen the man cured by a miracle, the prince's brother healed by Magellan, leading the priest into his house, and for this reason they had departed, fearing some evil chance. Pigafetta said, "No sooner had those two spoken their words than we heard great cries and groans. Then we quickly raised the anchors, and, firing several pieces of artillery at their houses, we approached nearer to shore." What they saw exceeded their worst imaginings. It was worse even than the massacre of Juan de Solis. Ginez de Mafra, among those who had remained behind, described the murderous chaos engulfing the sailors on shore. As the banquet was about to end, some armed people emerged from the palm grove and attacked the invitees, killing 27 of them, and captured the priest who had remained there and Juan Serrano, the pilot, who was an old man. Others, although there were few of them, swam to the ships and, helped by those aboard, cut the cables and set sail. The barbarians brought Serrano to the shore and said that they wanted to exchange him for ransom. The ransom was discussed, and they asked for an iron gun, which is what they fear the most. This was sent to them on a skiff, and upon seeing it, the Indians asked for more. No sooner would our men grant their request than the Indians would reply, asking for more. This continued until, realizing their intention, those aboard the ships did not want to remain there any longer, and said to Juan Serrano that he himself could very well see what was going on and how the Indians' words were all but a pretense. Serrano pleaded for his crew members to come to his rescue, but they refused to leave the safety of their ships for fear that they would be massacred as well. Pigafetta said, "Then Juan Serrano, weeping, said that as soon as we sailed he would be killed, and he said that he prayed God that at the day of judgment he would demand the soul of his friend João Carvalho." Serrano's desperate words fell on deaf ears, and his friend Carvalho refused to intervene. The May 1st massacre claimed many of the ablest and most prominent crew members. Serrano watched the ships weigh anchor, preparing to abandon him to bloodthirsty island warriors, seeking to reclaim their lost honor and dignity. Left behind by his own men, Serrano eventually met the same fate as his crew members. Enrique's revenge on the Europeans had been bloodier than anyone could have foreseen. Only 115 men remained of the 260 who had left Spain, and as they fled to safety, their last sight of Cebu was of enraged islanders tearing down the cross on the mountaintop and smashing it to bits. 5 days later, and half a world away, a weather-beaten vessel tied up at the harbor of Seville. It was San Antonio, part of the Armada de Malacca. It was May 6th, 1521, and the event marked the first news of the fleet since it left Sanlúcar de Barrameda on September 20th, 1519. No one ashore knew what to make of her arrival, for the fleet had not been expected to return for months. They would soon learn that Magellan had found the fabled strait after all, but before he could traverse it, San Antonio had been commandeered by mutineers fleeing Magellan's cruelty and excessive daring. She carried her captain, Estevao Gomez, his chief co-conspirator, Geronimo Guerra, and 55 men, including Magellan's cousin, Alvaro de Mesquita, whom the mutineers had stabbed and kept in irons throughout the return journey. Gomez had skillfully piloted the ship across the Atlantic to Spain. There had been talk of returning to Port St. Julian to rescue Cartagena and the priest whom Magellan had marooned, but in all likelihood the ship never attempted to rescue them. Instead, San Antonio made for the coast of Guinea to find water. Despite having braved the Atlantic Ocean alone, San Antonio's captain and crew felt no joy on seeing Seville's familiar cathedral, because they were returning in disgrace, mutineers who would face the prospect of an official inquiry, incarceration, and even punishment by death. They could console themselves in the knowledge that Guerra was related to Cristobal de Haro, who would finance the expedition. They could also draw strength from Magellan's lack of popularity in Spain, and they planned to destroy the Portuguese captain general's reputation, with tales of his poor judgment and brutal mistreatment of Spanish officers. But these stories had to be compelling because their lives depended on convincing the authorities that the mutiny had been necessary and justified. The moment King Charles heard that San Antonio had returned, he ordered the Casa de Contratación to restore all the merchandise and equipment aboard the ship to Cristobal de Haro, to whom Charles, perpetually strapped for cash to fund his empire, was deeply in debt. The Casa was to sell off anything of value. No one aboard San Antonio knew what had become of Magellan. They assumed, or hoped, that his recklessness and secret loyalty to Portugal had caused him to perish at sea, somewhere over the edge of the world, and the Casa was inclined to believe them. The weather-beaten San Antonio and her mutinous, ragtag crew of 55 were presumed to be the only survivors of what had once been the glorious Armada de Malacca. Within days of their return, the mutineers delivered their finely honed accounts to the Casa de Contratación. 53 out of the 55 members of the crew gave depositions, and the sudden activity threw the Casa's clerks into a frenzy. Mesquita, meanwhile, went directly from confinement aboard ship to jail on land. He was now in the custody of the admiral, where he is well guarded. The Casa's representatives insisted they were only protecting Mesquita from the others, but the deposed captain believed that he had been singled out for unfair treatment. The Casa did a remarkably thorough job in uncovering the details of the mutiny at the strait in the time allotted to them. The report included an elaborate description of the initial confrontations between Magellan and Cartagena shortly after the Armada's departure from the Canary Islands. As the report unfolded, a strong anti-Magellan bias became increasingly apparent. Not surprisingly, the mutineers rearranged events at Port St. Julian to suit their cause. To hear them tell it, they aroused Magellan to fury simply by asking him to obey the king's orders. Inevitably, the mutineers recast the climactic struggle at the strait in their favor. In their version, Mesquita provoked the rebellion by stabbing Gomez. In reality, of course, Gomez had stabbed Mesquita first. While the mutineers spun their tales for the Casa's representatives, Gomez and Guerra were held in custody, as was Mesquita, despite his claims that he was the mutiny's principal victim, not its perpetrator. Mesquita's account, so different from the mutineers' exculpatory version, received little attention and even less credence at the Casa de Contratación. In his defense, Mesquita presented the Casa with documents he had kept when he presided over the prolonged mutiny trial in Port St. Julian. The dossier recorded the rebellious actions of every accused crew member, the sentences they received, and Magellan's clemency, all to no avail. Mesquita was ordered to remain in prison while the mutineers went free. The ringleaders, Gomez and Guerra, even had their travel expenses to and from court reimbursed, while Mesquita, considered guilty until proven otherwise, was ordered to pay travel costs out of his own threadbare pocket. In their depositions, the crew members skillfully played on Spanish fears that Magellan was a Portuguese tyrant after all, a cunning agent of his native land who skillfully assembled the Armada de Malacca at Spain's expense merely to destroy it and to dupe King Charles. They embellished the stereotype with fresh horrors. Magellan was a murderer who tortured honorable Spanish officers with connections in the highest possible place, the church. They told the tragic tale of Cartagena, a Castilian officer who, through no fault of his own, was left to rot on a remote island by Magellan. As if that were not wicked enough, the captain general left a priest to the same miserable fate. On May 26th, Archbishop Fonseca, Cartagena's father, delivered his response to the depositions, and it became apparent that the mutineers' conspiracy to distort the truth had worked as planned. The bishop expressed shock and dismay at Magellan's treatment of Cartagena and Quesada. It seemed incredible that Spanish officers would be capable of mutiny, and there was no excuse for drawing and quartering one man and marooning the other. So the mutineers went free, for now, though a taint of suspicion clung to them, and they did not receive the back pay they claimed was due them. In Magellan's absence, his wife, Beatrice, became an object of suspicion, as if she were somehow involved with events at the other end of the world. The Casa de Contratación cut off her financial resources. The vindictive Archbishop Fonseca had even more punitive measures in store for Magellan's family. He ordered Beatrice and their young son to be placed under house arrest. They were forbidden to return to Portugal while the inquiry continued. The inquiry into the mutiny of San Antonio consumed 6 months, and in the end, Guerra and Gomez were set free in addition to all the sailors. Gomez even received a royal appointment to another expedition, a sure sign of rehabilitation. During the clamor arising from the unexpected return of the mutineers, not a word was heard from the young king who had authorized the expedition 2 years earlier, despite the petitions and correspondence pleading for his attention. Charles had not lost interest in the enterprise, but ever since the ships had sailed from Seville, he had been engulfed in political turmoil. His mother, Juana the Mad, lived on, hopelessly insane. Meanwhile, the young monarch, encouraged by his backers, was still making every effort to become the next emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, the most powerful political entity in Europe.